Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to talk about, give a rough overview of Eastern Europe following the death of Stalin, and really look at the question of living standards, because this is the thing which upon which Eastern Europe, the Soviet bloc in Eastern Europe, founders eventually. Living standards had been an issue under Stalin. There's an assumption that some students have that the five-year plans are exclusively about heavy industry, and the second five-year plan actually isn't. The second five-year plan, there's a heavy consumer element to it, and I know I talk about her work a lot, but if you read Everyday Stalinism by Sheila Fitzpatrick, she wrote, in the chapter called Palaces on a Monday, she talks at length about the new department stores that appeared in Moscow and the attempts under a Soviet system to create a consumer choice, which never really quite worked. So this was a consideration, and it shows you that obviously a repressive terror regime like Stalinism also had considerations about public opinion and the idea that raising living standards was a kind of an imperative of the regime. There's a famous speech where Stalin says essentially life has become more joyous, comrades, and talks about the sharing of the fruits of prosperity that Stalinism was supposedly creating. Anyway, so during the Cold War, the ability of both sides to provide growing living standards for their citizens was a key indicator of the success of the rival political systems. In America and Britain, obviously, and Western Europe, you have varying degrees of liberal democracy and varying degrees of free market capitalism. In Europe, particularly in West Germany, this is heavily tempered by the social market model, a large welfare state, meaning that labour markets are not subject to the vagaries of free market capitalism. They are quite well insulated with welfare and other measures to intervene to guarantee minimum levels of living standards. And the same is true in Britain with the development of the welfare state after 1945. And in America, really, the New Deal still perpetuates itself all the way up, perhaps even all the way up to Ronald Reagan. Some historians argue that Nixon himself was like the last New Dealer president. Not so sure about that one, but that's a different conversation. So you also have, in the 50s and 60s, a global economic boom, and almost historically unprecedented global economic boom, and capitalism seems to be able to generate a standard of living unseen before. And this becomes much more difficult during the 1970s. But in the West, in the 1970s, living standards in 1979 were still higher than those in 1969. Britain goes through a decade of turmoil, but British people are still essentially wealthier at the end of it than they were at the beginning. But in the Soviet-occupied Eastern Bloc, providing for East Germans, Czechs, Poles, Romanians and others was much more difficult. And this was in large part because of the legacy of Stalin himself. When Stalin dies in 53, the shockwaves that pass through Eastern Europe are significant. There are, in 1953, demonstrations that lead to an uprising in East Germany. By 1956, when Khrushchev denounces Stalin in a secret speech, there are riots that are bloodily suppressed in Poland. And then, of course, there is the Budapest uprising, which is violently suppressed by the Soviet Union. And this is as a result of Khrushchev's secret speech. Now, if you want to know more about the secret speech, there is a podcast dedicated to that. I must have done it a couple of years ago, but look back to the archive. I promise you it'll be there. So change isn't immediate in large parts of Eastern Europe. In East Germany, the Stalinist Walter Ulbricht clung on to power into the 1970s. In some of the other satellite states, there is obviously huge upheaval. The typical, the most studied example is Hungary. Soviet intervention in 1956 involved removal of the unpopular Stalinist Matthias Rakosi and his replacement, Ino Gero, was unable to keep down the revolt in October that year. And he was replaced by Janosz Kadar. And despite the fact that there's enormous bloodshed and loss of life on the streets of Budapest, Kadar himself, when he hangs on following the end of the uprising, was able to undo most of the measures instituted by the Stalinist Rakosi. There were basic freedoms granted to Hungarian citizens and a significantly better standard of living in Hungary develops. Hungary had traditionally always been a per capita wealthier country than the Soviet Union. But it must be remembered that Soviet military power stays in Hungary for a considerable amount of time thereafter, and it's a permanent reminder that dissent can be crushed at any time. 1968 in Prague also shows that this was a real possibility, although with significantly less bloodshed. So the world that Stalin had created rested on three institutions: Cominform, Comecon, and the Warsaw Pact. Cominform was founded in 1947, and it was replaced the Comintern, which the Soviets had agreed to dismantle during World War II, as partly as a kind of a gesture to the Allies to say, look, Comintern, which was the Communist International and designed to try to subvert Western democracies as much as possible, was now redundant because we're all friends and we're all fighting the Nazis. And it was always going to be superseded by Cominform in Stalin's eyes anyway. The role of Cominform was to coordinate the Communist parties of Eastern Europe under Soviet direction. Yet, despite Western propaganda to the contrary, it was clear from the outset, even when Stalin was in power, that there were limits to Soviet control. Initially, the Cominform was based in Belgrade, and Cominform moved to Bucharest following the expulsion of Josef Tito, the Yugoslav leader, from Cominform by the USSR. So a decision to base it in Belgrade in Yugoslavia is an interesting one, and the tensions between Stalin and Tito before Stalin died in 1953 were sufficient to have Stalin plotting to have Tito assassinated by 1953, and it's only the Stalin's death that leads Beria to call off the plot. The Warsaw Pact, Cominform actually stimulates the development of the Warsaw Pact. The pact was established in 1955, never included Yugoslavia. And this was, in effect, to be the military alliance that cemented the Eastern Bloc to the USSR. Economically developed countries like Czechoslovakia and East Germany, along with agrarian societies like Bulgaria and Romania, were treated not only as political satellites of the USSR, but economic ones as well. This meant that when their agriculture was collectivised, newly nationalised industries had 5-year plans imposed on them. There were, you know, if you imagine countries like East Germany, which would previously have been simply just Germany or the Third Reich, the 5-year plans were really quite alien things, and particularly in Czechoslovakia, which was perhaps the most advanced, modern and industrialised economy in Eastern to Central Europe after Germany, and had been a thriving hub of industry and manufacturing before the Second World War. The creation of a centralised, directive-led bureaucratic system to industrialise the country, or to create a forced pace of industrialisation, seemed to be completely ill at odds with what Czechoslovakia needed. But then if you consider that very little of this was about Czechoslovakia's needs and more about creating economic satellites that could be plundered by the Soviet Union, it all starts to make a lot more sense. The 5-year plans were designed to address shortages in the USSR, and they created a flow of cheap exports and raw materials so that the Soviet Union could rebuild its economy. Comecon was the Council for Mutual Economic Assistance, and it was introduced in 1949 to try to insulate the Soviet Union's new empire from economic ties with the West in the immediate aftermath of the war. We obviously have the Marshall Plan being touted by the USA, something that Stalin is highly suspicious of, perhaps with some good reason, and Stalin viewed it as an attempt to subvert Soviet communism, which it undoubtedly was. The reality was that Eastern European countries, traditionally trading partners with Germany and France, were locked into economic relations solely with the communist world and primarily with the USSR countries, again, a country that is really quite alien to them. Czechoslovakia had very deep ties with France before the Second World War, and Germany was the traditional hegemon in Eastern Europe that was able to refer to Eastern Europe, Eastern Central Europe, as Mitteleuropa, Germany's sphere of influence. Throughout the 50s and 60s, the Soviet system within Eastern Europe faced repeated challenges, not only just from uprisings such as East Germany, Budapest and Prague, but from other dissenting state members. So the idea that the Warsaw Pact was a cohesive and happy family is quite misleading, far from it. Albania left the Warsaw Pact in 1964, angry at Soviet attempts to become reconciled with Yugoslavia. Albania and Yugoslavia are traditionally bitter rivals, and when Khrushchev decided that it was time to bury the hatchet with Yugoslavia and bring Yugoslavia in from the cold, Albania, under the dictator Enver Hoxha,
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Typically eccentric style decides to actually exempt itself from the Warsaw Pact. Noticeably, when there's talk about Hungary leaving the Warsaw Pact, Khrushchev sends in the tanks to crush it because the possibility that it might become a non-aligned country or even, God forbid, join NATO is unconscionable. Obviously, the importance to the Soviet Union of Albania is considerably diminished, and Albania is able to leave the Warsaw Pact without any comeuppance. Albania then became Communist China's client state within Eastern Europe, and China had previously been wooing Albania away during the Great Leap Forward from 1958 to 62, where the Maoist famine that killed upwards of 40 million people. During that period of time, the Chinese were actually sending food shipments to Albania. Strange but true. The Romania as well followed suit in the early 60s, exploiting animosity between the USSR and China to break the hold of Moscow over the country. By the mid-60s, Romania was actively trading with the West, and there was little that Stalin's system could do about it. There was a famous story of how Nicolae Ceausescu wanted to buy jumbo jets from Britain and decided to purchase them with Romanian strawberries, large quantities thereof. So Romania is this really quite unconventional and anomalous entity within the Warsaw Pact, one that the Europe and America saw as being quite a useful potential client state, and the ties between the West and Romania really went quite deep. You can actually find my previous podcast on Romania, on the Holocaust and the Cold War, if you go back. But there was, it shows you that Moscow's control over her satellite states really was, as the 60s wore into the 70s, quite diminished. In Eastern Europe, the legacy of Stalinism presented each regime with the challenge of preventing widespread rejection of communist ideology. However, at the same time, governments from Poland to Romania had to present coherent explanations as to why the ideology had become so repressive and corrupted under Stalin. Essentially, Eastern European leaders had to do their own versions of the secret speech. Across the eastern part of the continent, revisionism became prominent in the mid-1960s as a new doctrine, and Warsaw Pact members sought to salvage communism by adapting it. This is something that's played out in the Soviet Union all the way through to Gorbachev. So we perhaps, you know, can communism be reformed? Can it be tamed? Can it be made to have a human face? The question is, if you try to do that, does it then become something else? Does it then become sort of West German-style social democracy? And does that result in parliamentary elections and the eventual ousting of communist parties, as will inevitably happen? And the answer eventually that Gorbachev comes out with in the 1980s is, if you try to reform communism, you will inevitably destroy it. It's not one of those particularly reformable ideas. In Poland, under Ladislaw Gomułka, and Hungary, under Janusz Kadar, economic policy became an arena in which intellectuals were able to express dissenting ideas. So economists and political theorists were actually able to appear in public debate, and actually suggest that Soviet communism wasn't functioning all that well. The question of how society should be economically ordered was so central to Stalin's thinking, and so inflexible while the Soviet dictator lived, that it only became permissible for limited dissent to be expressed following Stalin's death. And once you start to challenge the basic economic precepts of Soviet communism, you really are turning all sort of givens about the ordering of society and about class relations on their heads. By the mid-60s, economic policy was one area which the governments of Eastern Europe were able to exercise some degree of autonomy over. Under Stalin, ineffective and backward command economies had been imposed on far more industrially and technologically advanced countries such as Czechoslovakia and East Germany. The purpose was to set targets and quotas for foodstuffs and raw materials to be shipped back to the USSR, as we've already discussed. However, the economic rebirth of Western Europe developed throughout the 60s, increased the number of younger Czechs, Hungarians, East Germans, Romanians and others that looked to the Western living standards and hoped for improvements in their own conditions. There were various experiments in attempting to cater for consumer demand, which had obviously been long tolerated in the Soviet regime. However, when the USSR invaded Czechoslovakia in 68, following the Prague Spring, it was not demands for a more diverse economic policy or for greater civil liberties that prompted the invasion, but fears that Czechoslovakia would leave the Warsaw Pact. It was an attempt to create consumer societies without market economies that presented a greater challenge to communism in Eastern Europe. The most significant factor in the eventual decline and fall of the Iron Curtain and the end of the Cold War was the accumulation of debt. Debt doesn't get very often discussed and explored, but we're going to do that now. Poland is a good example. In 1970, the Polish leader Gomułka was forced to step down following the bloody suppression of rioting over falling living standards. He was replaced by Edward Gierek, who realised that living standards and consumerism were key concerns of the Polish people. Because Stalinism was no longer the device with which to hold societies together, new strategies had to be employed, and the ability to cater to the demands of ordinary people who demanded the kind of the rising living standards that they were seeing and experiencing all around the world. This was much easier than state repression. Gierek visited America in 1974 and was welcomed by President Gerald Ford. Top on the list of priorities was to purchase US manufacturing technology to build a new consumer economy. But it could only be paid for through borrowing. Gierek hoped that agricultural and raw material exports would eventually pay for the new infrastructure. The gamble that he embarked on appeared to initially to work. Foreign investment led to rapid growth in the first half of the 70s, with growth rates of 10% per annum on average. In 1975, while inflation and the economic crisis gripped Great Britain, an opinion poll showed that 3/4 of the population believed their living standards had improved significantly. However, the economic reforms existed within a dictatorial and authoritarian command economy, where corruption and nepotism were frequent and market mechanisms were largely non-existent. This led to an eventual slowdown of the rapid boom by 1979, a year where Poland's national income began to decline and the real price of the boom had to be paid. Poland owed $18 billion to Western banks, and much of Poland's industries now had to export scarce consumer goods and commodities overseas in order to pay back the debt, leading to shortages and price rises. In July 1980, the price of meat rose by 90%, and it's in this context that the strikes that developed into the Solidarity movement of the 1980s make sense. Solidarity doesn't spring from nowhere. It comes really from the economic crises of a state that has put its reputation on looking after the workers and now fails miserably. So in Romania, a similar process took place. Ceausescu, Nicolae Ceausescu, the dictator of the Socialist Republic of Romania, appeared to preside throughout the 70s over a booming economy. He was celebrated by Western leaders as a communist figure who was not beholden to Moscow and who was a reliable trading partner behind the Iron Curtain. But the economic expansion that Romania enjoyed throughout the period was not based on the improvement of living standards, but on the development of a large state-owned industry, which was normally heavy industry, and petrochemical factories. Romania has oil. These vast enterprises frequently overproduced commodities that were then unsellable domestically or internationally. The favourable view that Europeans and US leaders had of Ceausescu made banks more willing to lend money to the regime in order to improve its industrial technology. But a decade later, the national debts had increased by tenfold, peaking at $13 billion in 1982. The debts resulted in a collapse in living standards throughout the 1980s. Some economists argue that living standards almost halved. So this pattern was repeated across Eastern Europe, as it became a region that was no longer immune to the forces of economic globalisation that were sweeping the globe by the 1980s. The one power that might have prevented the economic penetration of the Soviet bloc during the 70s and 80s was the USSR itself, but Soviet leaders after Khrushchev were unlikely to do so. Not only had they abandoned any pretense that the USSR and its satellites were marching towards communist utopias, but they also dabbled in limited economic reforms themselves when Alexei Kosygin was given control of the Soviet economy from 1965 onwards. And there's, I'm sure, Domar Kosygin previously. Google it, but I'm sure you'll find it. Just like the Soviet bloc countries themselves, economic reform was attempted without any effort to change the institutions or the constitutions of either the Soviet Union or any of its satellite states. At no time did any Soviet or Allied leader consider reforms that might diminish the hold of the Communist Party itself on power. It's perhaps this, more than anything else, that made the collapse of the Soviet bloc inevitable, with the violent repression of dissidents seen in the Hungarian uprising of 56 and the Prague Spring of 68, the USSR had lost ideological legitimacy it claimed from its victory over Nazism. Its subsequent failure to provide economic stability made its collapse simply a matter of time. So the one thing that it was capable, supposedly capable of providing by the mid-1960s, economic well-being, it couldn't even manage that. And so nobody looked upon it as, a fair and noble, if slightly backward ideology. It lacks moral and economic legitimacy. Okay, well, that's gone for a bit longer than I thought, so I'm going to pause there. But do remember to get over to our iTunes page and give the Explaining History podcast a great review. It'd be really great if you can do that. Anyway, look forward to catching you on the next Explaining History podcast. I'll speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.